This is Nola Nordmarken, your host for this recording on Supervision and Boundaries, part of an online course on supervision by the Zur Institute at www.zurinstitute.com. I'm a marriage and family therapist in Southern California with practices in Santa Monica and South Pasadena. I am also a co-author with Dr. Zur of several CE courses, including Touch and Psychotherapy, The Professional Will, and Home Office Practice, as well as articles critiquing the DSM. Today I will be interviewing Dr. Ofer Zur. Dr. Zur is a licensed psychologist, fellow of American Psychological Association, instructor, lecturer, ethics consultant, and expert in witness and private psychotherapy practice in Sonoma, California. He has been in practice for over 20 years and is director of the Zur Institute, LLC, at www.zurinstitute.com, which offers over 120 innovative and challenging online continuing education courses for psychologists, counselors, social workers, nurses, and other mental health practitioners. Dr. Zur is most known for his effort to humanize the field of psychotherapy and counseling and is a fierce advocate of appropriate and flexible application of therapeutic boundaries, such as touch, self-disclosure, gifts, etc. Through his writing and his teaching, he has assisted and asserted that rigid application of risk management protocols of no touch and no self-disclosure can actually be harmful to clients as well as being unethical. In this unique audio, or I may say pioneer recording, Dr. Zur will explore the intersection of supervision and therapeutic boundaries. So let's start. I might want to start by crossing a boundary and calling you Ofer instead of Dr. Zur. Would that be okay with you?
Yeah, that's good. And if I can call you Nola as well.
That's fine. You know, Ofer, I remember being at one of your workshops a number of years ago and hearing you speak about boundaries in psychotherapy. I came from training and supervision that was fairly rigid in terms of compliance with traditional boundaries, from a framework of protecting the client from harm as well as from some rather fear-based tactics related to avoiding legal sanctions of any kind. And I often thought that although sometimes these boundaries did support the highest need of the client, that often they did not. And I suspected that sometimes adhering to these rigid boundaries might actually be harmful. So I found your way of looking at boundaries to be much more applicable to the clinical needs of individual clients. And I found this way of thinking freed me up as a clinician to integrate my boundary considerations based on specific needs of each client rather than using a one-size-fits-all model. Could you start with just the basics by talking about what constitutes boundaries in psychotherapy and supervision?
Thank you for the intro. It's really, that was kind of my mission in some regard, to put the client's welfare first. And actually, I believe that if we serve them right, we also protect ourselves in a good way. So defensive medicine in the most traditional and rigid way can be harmful to both. But to your question about what are boundaries in therapy? Boundaries therapy usually are issues that involve self-disclosure, touch in supervision. It could be touch of the client by the supervisee, or even the supervisee by the supervisor. Location of therapy, the time, the space, gift exchange between either a supervisee and client, or supervisee and his supervisor or her supervisor. Dual relationship, of course, bartering, etc. And then we have, in more recent years, we have a whole new set of boundaries that we are still kind of finding our way through understanding them, is digital boundaries about online self-disclosure, supervisee Googling supervisors or vice versa, communication between therapist and clients, or between supervisor and supervisee via text, cell phone, email, chat, video conferencing, Skype, and texting between all clients and supervisees, supervisees and supervisors, etc. So we have kind of a whole new area of boundaries that needs to be considered both in therapy as well as in supervision.
You know, it still surprises me that as a field we take such a tight stance on specific boundaries. After all, for example, physical touch has been well researched for over 50 years and it's been found to be highly effective therapeutic intervention. And then on the issue of self-disclosure, humanistic psychologists and feminist psychologists consider self-disclosure to be essential. In your writings and teachings, you've talked about different types of boundaries. What are they?
You know, you're absolutely right. The name boundary to a clinically proven interventions is ludicrous in some regard. So let's try to see how, kind of, what do we mean by boundaries? Boundaries in general define the therapeutic relationship or what has been called the therapeutic frame. And the role of boundaries is to distinguish psychotherapy from social, familial, business, and other type of relationship. Some boundaries are drawn around therapeutic relationship, and some are including concerns, and this would be including concerns of time, place, session, fees. And some boundaries are drawn between therapist and client, or between supervisor and supervisee, rather than around them. And this would be the self-disclosure type, physical contact, giving and receiving gift, meeting outside the office, texting, emailing, etc. So we have kind of these two types of boundaries between and around therapies. Then we have also the difference between boundary crossing and boundary violation. This is just extremely important differentiation. Boundary crossing is what you mentioned, is referred to clinically proven interventions such as touch and self-disclosure, etc. It's referred to any deviation from strict or analytical, only in the office, emotionally distanced form of therapy, or deviation from rigid risk management. So boundary crossings are clinically effective intervention such as self-disclosure, home visits, non-sexual touch, gift and bartering. In contrast, boundary violation occur when therapists or supervisors cross the line of decency and violate or exploit and harm their client. So we have kind of a few differentiation here.
And I think that's where over the years a lot of the confusion has taken place. I'm curious about how you see dual relationships or multiple relationships relating specifically to supervision.
So that's a very good place to start from the boundary discussion and supervision. Dual relationship, in the most general term, it fits in therapy and supervision, refer to any situation where multiple relationship exists between therapist and client, between or between supervisee and supervisor. For example, dual relationship and when the supervisee or the clients are also friends, or also a student, family member, employee, business associate. So whenever the therapist or the supervisor have a secondary hat, an additional relationship, this is when we talk about multiple relationship. The mythology around multiple relationships that it's always unethical and it often leads to sex. And this is kind of very crazy thinking. Say it again?
That's quite a leap.
It's quite a leap. So, but the fact is that many dual relationship, both between supervisor and supervisee, as well as between patient and supervisee or patient and therapist, are unavoidable in small communities, in medical institution, in training institution like the Jung training institution or the psychoanalytic one, or in small community within the church in downtown LA or the LGBT community in San Francisco. Sometimes it's unavoidable. You live in a community and you bump into other people whom you are either being supervised by or being getting therapy from. And so some of the dual relationship are even mandated, like in prison setting or in military setting. You must have dual relationship in order to function as a supervisor or as a therapist in this setting. And some of them are avoidable as well. So this is kind of the general definition of dual or multiple relationship. Then you ask about how does it fit into supervision. And this is a very complicated question because there are many types of multiple relationship and multiple loyalties within the supervisory arena. Supervisor have relationship with the supervisee, has obligation, legal commitment for the patient. The supervisor has relationship to be the gatekeeper for the profession. The supervisor have relationship to the community at large. So we have like four relationships that are taking place at the same time just from the supervisor point of view. The supervisee has also multiple relationship inherent in all supervisor-supervisee relationship. The supervisee has relationship with a client. The supervisee often have relationship with the agency where he or she gets supervision. And the supervisee, of course, have relationship to the supervisor. To make things even more complicated in this regard, or more intricate or more complex, the agency or the Department of Mental Health or the hospital or the clinic where supervision often takes place, they have issues directly relationship to the supervisee, to the supervisor, to the client, as well as to the profession or sometimes to the accrediting agencies. So we have all this complex multiple relationship that coexist in each and every supervisory relationships.
That's a lot for supervisors to consider with dual relationships. Are there state laws governing this?
There are. Each state has some kind of laws that govern the relationship. It may come via the licensing board. So it may be regulations by the licensing board. Sometimes the code of ethics also impose some regulation as well. And the regulations are in general that most supervisors or universities may have their own standards, and so does the Department of Mental Health, that supervisors cannot conduct supervision with a spouse, a former lover, or student. So it's very important that supervisors and supervisees learn the state law and the professional association code of ethics, as well as a licensing board restriction.
So it's one general injunction. What would that be?
You know, it's really need to go state by state. We know from the code of ethics that for therapist clients, the general injunction is not to get involved in dual relationships that may impair one's objectivity, judgment, or may reasonably lead to harm and exploitation. But often when it comes to supervision, the bar is higher due to more regulations by the licensing boards about who you can conduct or you cannot conduct supervision with.
I'm curious, I'd like to ask some questions about self-disclosure, but first I want to see if there's anything else you wanted to say on the topic.
I think it's an important part to remember for many supervisees that get supervision in a training institution like the Jungian or psychoanalytic one, university setting. And in all these places, multiple relationship would be very complicated and unavoidable. The institution kind of very incestuous in many ways. That means that the graduate students may be on committees, whether it would be a committee for the once a year Christmas party, and they may find themselves the supervisor there as well, or the supervisee in the university setting may find himself or herself with a student kind of on a track team. So in small community or kind of distinct communities, there are numerous unavoidable dual relationship, both between supervisees and clients, as well between supervisors and supervisees. And I'm shocked sometimes to see this, how little is written about such a prevalent concern. And it's kind of almost a denial that that these things exist, and people demonize dual relationship rather than understand it's a, in some regard, healthy part of complexities of interconnectedness in interconnected communities. So acknowledge, I think it's important for supervisors to acknowledge the multiplicity of loyalties and the multiplicity of relationship. The supervisor to know that they have obligation to the profession as well as to the client, as well as to the supervisees, as well as to the clinic or the university. And consciously juggle this multiple loyalties rather than ignoring or denying them. Often getting consultation, reading texts, have a lot of work on dual relationships that people can use or have been using. So in sum, Rob, before we move to the self-disclosure that you mentioned, we come to dual relationships that's unavoidable. They are complex and rich and must be acknowledged and taken into consideration in order to provide effective supervision.
And that is so closely related to self-disclosure. How does self-disclosure apply in supervision?
First, kind of quickly defining it, so make sure that we are all talking about the same thing. Self-disclosure is a revelation of personal rather than professional information about the supervisor to the supervisee or about the supervisee to the client. And
then there would be different types of self-disclosure.
Yeah. They can be verbal or non-verbal. That means I can tell you, oh, my oldest son is ready to go to college. That would be a verbal. Non-verbal, if you come to my office and see a picture of me on a motorcycle, you will get information about it. It can be intentional. That means if I consciously put a picture or consciously talk to you about something personal, it could be unintentional when I accidentally say something or you bump into me in the community as a supervisee or as a client and you get to know things about me. Some things are unavoidable, as my accent, my gender, my age, and some self-disclosure can be avoidable. Then we have the whole brave new world. We'll talk hopefully later on about the digital or internet self-disclosures. It's kind of completely new territory for all of us. And sometimes the supervisee or the client may take action to create self, to explore about the therapist or the supervisor, and this would be kind of supervisee's action, and this would be a different kind of categories as well. Two more categories, if we need to categorize it. Some of it can be intentional and unintentional. I guess I mentioned it before, so this is kind of important differentiation as well.
So I could see also where you spoke earlier about different settings, and that would be a very important factor with regard to self-disclosure as well as dual or multiple relationships. I think small towns or military bases, reservations, prisons, and how some self-disclosure would be unavoidable.
Absolutely. Add to that, perhaps, when you do organizational development, you work in certain settings, psychiatric hospital, inpatient setting, a sports psychology, you may be traveling with your clients or with your supervisees, big department like where you live, the LA Department of Mental Health. I mean, supervisors are not unknown entities. They are kind of almost semi-colleagues. in some regard, even though they have some legal and ethical duties. So yes, the setting is extremely important.
And how does that apply to supervision?
You know, as I kind of mentioned, for example, in small communities, the supervisee will know a lot about the supervisor just being in a small community and going to church together or going to a football game together, having the kids in the same or only school, going to the gym together, etc. Not much different. It will be in small communities, disabled community, minority communities, LGBT communities, spiritual communities, etc. 12 steps, sometimes supervisors and supervisees end up on the same AA meeting or other self-help program. And as I mentioned earlier, psychiatric hospital and training institutions are often mix and match with a lot of knowledge about the supervisor and about the supervisee by the client, just with the nature of the setting. If a supervisor uses a home office, this will be increased self-disclosure. You wrote the continuing education course for us on home office, where you identify the multiple ways that clients and supervisees are going to find information about the supervisor or therapist just by sheer attending the home office session.
There's so much that's verbal and nonverbal and has to do with setting. I'm also thinking about how this weaves in with special populations.
You're right on in regard to our special population that we have clinical data that self-disclosure is actually extremely effective. LGBT, that sometimes an LGBT client will call and want to kind of do some interview with the therapist or the supervisor on the phone, and they'll ask about the sexual orientation. Often not because they care whether you are straight or gay, they just want to know, do you feel comfortable talking about sexual orientation? Veterans, clinically it's important to have a lot of self-disclosure, sometimes within the self-help and the rehab communities. Parenting is important. If I work with a supervisee who is with young children and to understand her pressures or his pressures on that, it helps a lot if I'd be able to say, I know what it feels like not to sleep for the last 5 months or whatever. Spiritual concerns are very important in supervisors, supervisees, as well as supervisees, clients, relationship, because often clients will ask, what is spiritual orientation? Do you believe in God? A small ethnic community, due to oppression and racism, sometimes feel more comfortable within the group. And there's some research to talk about abused women may be beneficial more with working with other abused women, and the only way they'll know about it is through kind of self-disclosure, both as a supervisor as well as a therapist.
Over, what do you see as being some of the most helpful aspects of self-disclosure?
It's like talking about what are some of the benefits of breathing air or drinking water. It's like such a basic part of human nature to the familiarity that comes with self-disclosure, increased trust, increased positive therapeutic relationship, help people learn via modeling. But most importantly, just increase the sense of familiarity and comfort zone, which is so important for supervisees. So if the supervisees knows about the supervisor relationship to God or political affiliation, it can have a very powerful effect on the supervisor-supervisee relationship, as increased familiarity and trust and positive relationship. But it's almost so obvious with self-disclosure. I know the psychodynamic or psychoanalytic may find clinical reasons not to do that, and I respect their perspective, but it's important to remember that familiarity that comes via transparency is essential for human connection. And on the other hand, cold and emotionally distant and non-disclosing, rigid supervisors are less likely to be effective because they did not cultivate familiarity and trust. And the same is true for psychotherapy and counseling.
So in thinking about self-disclosure, how would one assess what makes a certain self-disclosure with a certain client ethical or appropriate?
You're right. It's a different client will require perhaps different amount and different type of transparency. Different supervisees may need or require or can benefit from supervisors' transparency. So ethically, what's important is that when the supervisor or the supervisee or the therapist are doing self-disclosure, that they have a clear professional, clinical rationale that what they do is with the supervisee or the client welfare in mind. So this is kind of one rule that can identify that I don't do it just because I need to get things off my chest. I do it because my supervisee or my client is likely to benefit from this exposure.
When I think about all of the different factors that are regarded in self-disclosure, there's what you've said about digital natives versus digital immigrants. That's a really big one. And also encouraging versus discouraging styles. What else would you put in that list?
You know, you're very familiar with a digital native, digital immigrant. Perhaps, if I may, I'll take a minute to explain it. When it comes to self-disclosure, we have a huge generational differences here. The young ones, the people who were born into the digital world and get to play computer games at age 2 or age 5 or 6, what we call digital natives, digital world is their native land. They have a different sense of self-disclosure or transparency or privacy that us digital immigrants, you and I, were introduced to computers probably in our 30s at best. So we had to immigrate into digital world, and some of us immigrated enthusiastically and some of us immigrated reluctantly. But regardless, the natives have, if you just go on YouTube or you just go on Facebook or whatever, you go online where the natives hang out, you will see that you can find incredible details, private details, nude pictures, compromised clothing, what we call, the immigrants will call compromise. And you'll find drunkenness, drugs, I mean, things that will be unheard of for digital immigrants, for the older people, for the baby boomers generation and above, to contemplate, to put on a bulletin board in the middle of downtown or on the front page of the New York Times, which is really what they do when they put things on Facebook and or YouTube. So we see a huge generational divide. So when digital immigrants are withholding kind of personal information from digital natives, the natives probably will just raise their eyebrow and kind of, we don't understand what's with them. Mm-hmm. It's because they have such a different sense of privacy that, I mean, I'm still kind of trying to get used to that, to what my kids will put online and what's a comfort zone. So this is kind of a huge difference between the generation. And then there's cultural differences. You know, I come from a culture in the Middle East where we are much more self-disclosure that Norway or Sweden or other Northern European culture. So kind of the Hispanic community in South America would be much more disclosing than North American in general. So there's also cultural differences, as well as, of course, as we always know, personal differences. And supervisors need to know the difference. So does supervisees, and so do therapists and counselors.
So going back to what you were saying about the digital age and transparency, how can supervisees gain information about their supervisors? I've heard about a level system for that. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, there are many ways that supervisees are going to find out information about the supervisors. And what supervisors need to understand is supervisees, especially the young ones, will quickly go to Google and do some kind of searching as a habit, kind of while they're texting and while they're watching something on their television or iPads, whatever it is. So it's kind of in listening to music at the same time. So kind of, so we have, I gave it five levels of exploration. The first level is just curiosity, when the supervisee will just perhaps Google the therapist by putting the first last name and perhaps a PhD or LCSW or MFT. Then the next level will be what I call due diligence. And that means a bit thorough research of Yelp.com, licensing boards, go to www.complain.com. And this will be kind of appropriate due diligence search for information about the supervisor or the therapist or the supervisee by the client. Then the third level comes an intrusive search. And you may go on Facebook. And you may even, the next level will be deceitfully try to become a friend on Facebook. And some people are just clicking yes to every friend's request because they want to have more and more friends. So deceitfully, you can become a friend of your supervisor if they are just indiscriminately taking everybody who requests to be a friend on Facebook. And then the last level is illegal search or cyber stalking. And this is for very little money. Between $10 and $60, everybody can find almost all information about the supervisors by paying somebody to do cyber stalking. And within 10 minutes, we can find their financial records, criminal records, marital records, and everything else in between.
When you think about Big Brother watching you, Big Brother is huge in this regard.
Big Brother can have access to information. I'm not sure if Big Brother cares about the information, but let's say if Big Brother cares, they can find the information. So I'm not losing sleep on that.
So with everything that's changed in the digital era, what can supervisors and supervisees expect from modern day clients?
Supervisor can expect that supervisees, as a modern informed consumer of supervision, will Google them. Similarly, supervisees and clients can find out that modern, informed, modern-day consumer will Google them. And the supervisors may find evaluation on Yelp.com by the supervisees. They may find web posting, especially by disgruntled one. So they may find comments on Facebook. So it's an open field for supervisees and clients to critique, to even harass, sadly so, their supervisor with not easy way for supervisor or supervisees to respond when they indeed are being trailed. But kind of one thing perhaps I would like to make sure that I said to both the supervisors and supervisees, you know, what I tell to my children is consider anything you post online as tattooed on your forehead. That means just be careful with any kind of posting. So this would be highly relevant for supervisees and who may be exposed to the client or to supervisors, to know that everything they put online is likely to be read by the supervisee or by the client.
There's something that I can't remember the name of it right now, but it's a Google search. Do you remember the name of that?
You know, you may be referring to the Google Alerts.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's good you brought it up. That, and actually, I thought that you have used it yourself, the Google Alert.
I actually have, yeah.
Okay, so you tell us.
I've Googled myself regularly, and I do have Google Alerts. I've also had clients alert me to things that they have found about me on the internet. And for me personally, there have been a few instances of benign mistakes, like where I practice and false contact information. But I've known other people who have had some really serious, invalid, negative comments posted on them.
So I know that you have your Google Alerts. I'm really pleased, and I really advocate that all supervisors and all supervisees that listening to this recording will get a Google Alert. So as a supervisor, you know what your supervisees can find about you. As a supervisee, you'll know what your clients can find about you. So when you go to www.google.com/alerts, it's free. You sign up. For example, I put different combination. I put Dr. Ofer Zur. Then I put Ofer Zur. Then I put Dr. Zur. Then I put Ofer Zur PhD or Ozur. So I put like six different combination in my Google Alerts. And each one of them is in quote. And once a week, I get all the people or all the web pages that include any of this combination that I put online. It doesn't cost anything. You don't need to get it necessarily every day unless it's some big crisis. But I suggest that all therapists who are listening to this recording, all supervisors, and also to tell the supervisees, get Google Alerts. It's something that needs to be done in this 21st century, regardless whether you have a web page or not. Because people put complain about you, and you need to know. People write nice things about you. People write things that are not accurate. Whatever the people do, it's important for you to know, because often your clients know that, whether they tell you that or not.
What would you suggest someone do if they find negative evaluations from clients or supervisors posted on the web?
You know, that's a good question, and I'll answer it kind of briefly. Don't be impulsive. Don't protest. Consult with experts. If you can't solve it amicably, there are a few organizations that may help you get your reputation, called reputationdefender.com, or another one is EFF.org. Get a consultation, but don't protest too loud. If you protest too loud, it may bring much more negative evaluation than you can. So damage control will be even harder. At the end of the day, you probably need to do a lot of surrender. But consult first.
Ofer, I'd like to shift now, if you will, to one of my favorite topics, gifts in therapy and in supervision.
Yeah, that's a interesting topic. I think that generally we have more gift concern between supervisees and client rather than supervisor and supervisees. But the gifts can be between supervisees and client, between clients and supervisee, between supervisor and supervisee, between supervisee and supervisor and the clinic involved. Sometimes parents of children are involved as well. And what we need to know about gifts that can be appropriate or inappropriate, that can be expensive or inexpensive, what's between the supervisor and supervisee is sometimes, you know, the end of supervision, giving some acknowledgement gift to the supervisee, kind of a celebratory, can be very nice. A DVD for birthday, flower for wedding, kind of symbolic. I'm going to Jerusalem in a week, so I'll bring some rocks to some of my clients who really asked me to bring rocks from Jerusalem. And when I had a supervisee, I also kind of, if it was appropriate, I would be more than happy to bring a rock from Jerusalem or water from the Jordan River if the supervisee was spiritually inclined or it has meaning for them, this kind of gift. So this kind of gifts are very, very appropriate when it's done with taste and the right intention. And again, it can be between supervisees and supervisors, as well as between client and supervisee. The supervisor's responsibility to monitor the exchange of gifts between supervisee and client, so it's ethical and it's appropriate and clinically appropriate. So the supervisor have a duty here to be thoughtful about the gift exchange without being rigid, and to understand that around the holidays or the end of therapy or wedding, graduation, birth, confirmation, etc., things like that, it's very appropriate to do some gift exchange. But this is something that supervisors need to oversee of the relationship, the gift exchanges between supervisee and client, as well as between supervisee and supervisors.
So this has to do also with the therapeutic relationships, I imagine, the modality, the process, the timing, culture, age, orientation.
Yeah, excellent list. It's a list of what's the context of therapy, which is what you cited before is relevant for self-disclosure. Who is the client? What is the setting? What's the therapeutic modality? What's a relationship? Who is a therapist?
What does the code of ethics say about gifts?
You know, there's another mythology here that the code of ethics have a stand about do not give gifts, and which is kind of completely untrue. If I did a search, thorough search about this question, and the following code of ethics not even mentioned the word gift in their codes. This would be American Psychiatric Association, American Psychological Association, California Association of Married and Family Therapists, NASW, NBCC. I mean, and the list goes on and on about codes of ethics do not even mention gifts. What's important from an ethical point of view is that the gift has to have be done with the welfare of the supervisee or welfare of the client in mind. So whether supervisee or supervisor accept a gift, whether supervisee accept a gift from a client or supervisor accept a gift or give a gift to a supervisee, it has to have some clinical intention. And not just to buy love or to obsessively give gifts. And there's one more myth I would like to mention. Some people say that inexpensive gifts are always ethical. That's not true, because pornographic card or extremely violent card, just an image even, that costs 1 cent can be highly inappropriate. And of course, large gifts are very tricky and in general considered unethical. Again, depends on the situation, but generally very expensive gifts as tickets for baseball, expensive tickets to baseball or other kind of cars, and etc. are very tricky, generally considered unethical, even though it's sometimes to be interesting to see a situation where even that may be ethical under very kind of close scrutiny.
Ofer, let's move on to the next boundary, touch. It's so unfortunate that so much of what is discussed about touch in psychotherapy or supervision has to do with how touch can harm. While this is definitely true, there are just so many ways in which touch can be appropriate, helpful, and even healing in the context of therapy and supervision. I'm particularly interested in the work of Dr. Tiffany Field of the Touch Research Institute, and they've found how loving touch releases a cascade of healing, balancing neurochemicals. And there are so many types of touch. What are some of them that are particularly relevant to our topic?
You know, this is an area that I should interview you. You know about this area much more than I do, more specifically, that and what you said was just beautiful about the importance of touch and how touch is really just part of human nature, back to the air we breathe and the water we drink. Without touch, we cannot grow. Without touch, we cannot develop well. Kids who are not being touched become antisocial and very physically ill. So back to the type of touch, touch can be appropriate or inappropriate, can be ethical or unethical, can be sexual or non-sexual, can be soothing, arousing, or neutral, can be comforting, or can be unsettling. Can initiate by the therapist, can be initiated by the supervisor, can be initiated by the supervisees, can be initiated by the client. It can be part of verbal psychotherapy or part of much more body-oriented psychotherapy.
Now, Ofer, when I think about it, touch touches at a very deep level. It is literally the first of our senses to develop and one of the last senses we are aware of as we die. So being so primary, it has such possibility for reaching a person's depths. And so sadly, especially in our Western culture, touch is tightly boundaried between people of different ages and races, gender, class, culture. I can see that the whole topic of touch and therapy and supervision must be very complex, yet we don't learn much about it in our graduate programs, with the exception that much of the time we're just told, don't touch. I'd like to hear more of your thoughts on this.
You know, it's so true, and it's so sad that we don't have a semester or two or three or four just on one of what has been proven as one of the most important ways that people interact. So, you know, we mentioned before, kind of, there's many touches on types. We need to be able to differentiate. In the article that we wrote together, we have touch, ritualistic, conversational, consolation touch, reassuring, playful, grounding, task-oriented, when you tell people kind of where to sit or how to walk, coercive. It can be instructional, how to do things, how not to do things. It can be celebratory as a high five. It can be experiential. It can be referential. And can be also sexual, hostile, or violent. And it's important to know that the three types of inappropriate type of touch, both in supervision and in therapy, is sexual touch, hostile, aggressive, or violent touch, as well as punishing touch.
And then there are some of the unspoken Western cultural taboos, like don't touch the opposite gender, don't touch same gender friends, don't touch yourself, don't touch strangers, do not touch the elderly and the sick, don't touch those who are dying, don't touch those who are of higher status.
You know, it's so true. I mean, I did a consultation, which is kind of not supervision, but of course closely related to somebody, and described to them that there's one client that I have that we spend most of the hour. She's an elderly woman in her 90s, and nobody touches her. She feels like she's untouchable. And it's a client that I had many years ago, and back in Berkeley. And what we did, we kind of sat sometimes for 45 minutes, and the only thing she wanted just to hold my hand. At 90 years old, nobody touched her except medical touch when she is admitted to the emergency room, and the medics kind of touch her in the way that medics do. And that's all what she needed for healing and connection, to feeling grounded, to feeling that life is worth living. It was just this half an hour, whatever it was, of just being her hand being held. But then we don't supervise our supervisees well around these issues of touch. We don't model to them touch. And as a result, they take this risk management idiotic idea that you will be safer from lawsuits if you don't touch, or you'll be safer from court complaints if you don't touch, which has no base in any statistics or research. The opposite, the better relationship you have with your clients or supervisees, the less they're likely to file complaints. And touch will be one way to affirm the connection. Of course, you and I can talk about touch for a long time, but I'm aware that we don't have much time.
Just quickly, when I think about boundary crossings rather than boundary violations and ethics and touch, it reminds me of a story I've heard you tell about a female client reclining in bed and her male therapist is there with her. Could you tell that story quickly?
You know, this is a story about context, and that I asked, actually, it came partly from Gerald Kutcher. It's a variation of his story, who was an APA president. That imagine, I asked people in my ethics class, imagine a woman laying in bed and her therapist sitting next to her bed and stroking her hair, and he tells her, I love you. And she tells him, please don't stop. So when I ask people in my class, what would come to mind, everybody thinks it's unethical and illegal and should lose her license because it's sexual and stuff like that, because they imagine this scene to be in the therapist's office. And in a standard therapy that she's laying on the bed and he's stroking her hair and tells her, I love you. But if you take this scene and take it to the hospital, imagine that she had 5 years of cancer and she was told she has 2 days to live before she dies. She invites her therapist of the last 6-7 years to come to say goodbye, and she's laying on a hospital bed. He's stroking her hair. He tells her, crying with tears in his eyes, I love you. And she said, please don't stop. So context, what's not appropriate in one context may be highly appropriate in another context. And you mentioned before, what's the context? What setting? You work with adolescents. Do you do high five? You go to adventure therapy. You sleep perhaps in the same tent. You do rope courses. You have a lot of touch and holding. And I've played basketball when it was appropriate with a reluctant teenage patient that nothing else would reach him except playing on a court. And it was physical, and it was another form of touch. It was playful touch. So you're absolutely right. Touch can be understood only within its context, and absolutely clear the sexual touch between supervisees and supervisors, between clients and supervisees, is unethical and illegal.
Okay, what are some of the more important considerations for touch in therapy?
I think what we just talked, the client's gender, age, the client history, the setting of therapy, the nature of the relationship, therapist attitude towards touch, what's the methodology being used, the client's inclination to sexualize. I wouldn't play basketball with a teenage girl or teenage boy who are highly attracted to me. And I would not necessarily even introduce any kind of touch. I need to know the difference.
Are you ready to shift gears here to the next boundary out of office?
Yeah, we're going to do it fast probably because our time is running out a little bit.
And I'm sure it has a lot to do with particular situations, populations, conditions, and settings that require leaving the office. What are some of these?
You know, there's many, many reasons to leave the office, or what are called out-of-office experience. Some of them are part of the treatment plan. That means if I do fear of flying or work with agoraphobic or go to anorexic lunch, this is part of the treatment plan. It's not dual relationship, it's just leaving the office. Then a home visits for a bedridden patient or hospital visit. Home visits are becoming huge right now, kind of with the aging population. It becomes a standard of millions of people being treated via home visit. Equine therapy is done outside the office, adventure therapy, of course, and treating the homeless on the street. All of this, our therapy takes place outside the office. It's, again, not dual relationship. It's just what I call out-of-office experience. Then there are a third type of out-of-office experience where you attend the graduation of your supervisee, of your client, or you, if your client is an architect, you take a tour of the garden that he or she created, or attend a school play with a shy client. And then come the issue of dual relationships, that you bump into your supervisee or your client in the community, and that can create dual relationship in small community. And then we have also accidental encounters that are very common on college campuses and military bases and and in small communities. So what's important for, kind of in brief, for the supervisor to make sure that supervisors are open to guide the supervisees through out-of-office experience without calling it dual relationship, but it's not, without calling it unethical, because it's a very important form of therapy, and many clients can only receive this kind of care outside the office. I wish I could talk more about it, but it seems like probably...
Can you touch on some of the more potential advantages of therapy outside the office, or does that pretty well cover it?
I think it's covered, because some, if you have a bedridden client, the only thing you can reach him either by visit or by doing telehealth. And that's another form, if not a boundary, that we won't have a chance to talk to, that there is a growing, hugely growing ways of delivering a supervision, which is definitely a boundary issue, via teleconferencing, emails, voice, phone, and etc. So the delivery of telehealth, which will also be covered in this course of supervision and boundaries, we have a whole section just on the what we call cyber supervision, the delivery of supervision via telehealth and digital means.
Ofer, I want to thank you so much for everything you've shared with us today. In closing, is there anything you would like to add?
I would like to add to supervisors, just take your supervisees as a precious learning curve, and with very little rigidity, hold them through this journey of learning to be flexible, to be thoughtful, to be caring, and to be human as they do therapy. And if you have done this one as a supervisor, you really achieved your goal, and of course, ethically and clinically competent.
Thank you so much, Dr. Zur.
More than welcome.